Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. It looks, if you head to the front page of our BBC News website, it looks just like any other meeting of any top officials in any posh boardroom at pretty much any point in the last goodness knows how many years. Men in suits on executive chairs sitting either side of a polished table. But this is, at the same time, an extraordinary picture because of who the men are, where they are, and what they're discussing. Marco Rubio, the brand new US Secretary of State, across that polished table from Sergei Lavrov, the long-serving Russian foreign minister. They're in the Saudi capital, Riyadh, and just days after President Trump held his 90-minute phone call with President Putin, Americans and Russians spent more than 4 hours discussing, at a very senior level, how to bring the war in Ukraine, the war which Russia started with its full-scale invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago, how to bring that war to an end. After the talks, the three-man American delegation, led, as I said, by Marco Rubio, spoke to reporters.
For 3 years while this conflict has raged, no one else has been able to bring something together like what we saw today, because Donald Trump is the only leader in the world that can. So no one is being sidelined here. But President Trump is in a position that he campaigned on to initiate a process that could bring about an end to this conflict. And from that could emerge some very positive things for the United States, for Europe, for Ukraine, for the world. But first it begins by the end of this conflict. And so the only thing President Trump's trying to do is bring about peace. It's what he campaigned on. It's something the world should be thanking President Trump for doing.
Travelling with Mr. Rubio is our State Department correspondent Tom Bateman, and just before we came on air, I caught up with him from Riyadh. What does he sense has been the outcome of this first such high-level meeting in years?
Well, my sense is at the end of this meeting, and I've just been in the room with the US delegation as they were giving some comments shortly after this more than 4 hour meeting broke up, is they're portraying this in a very positive light. They think it was upbeat in their view, and they've come out of it basically with a plan, an agreement with the Russians. They're talking about this as a 4-point agreement that would involve restoring diplomatic ties, their mutual embassies with the Russians, working on that, ending the war in Ukraine in a way they say that is fair and sustainable. There was a lot of emphasis on their third point, which is working on economic opportunities with the Russians. That was mentioned repeatedly, in fact, by Mr. Rubio and the two other senior White House advisors with him. And then establishing or continuing this high-level negotiation process with the Russians to try and move things forward. So they've come out of this with a plan. I think it's going to continue to surge, you know, anxiety through Europe because they're locked out of this particular part of the process. The Ukrainians were not invited and were not at the table. And it's always been the position of the Ukrainians. There should be no decisions made about Ukraine without the involvement of Ukraine. Well, it felt very much to me, hearing Marco Rubio speak, that they are making decisions that already will have an impact and affect Ukraine potentially quite deeply. And the Ukrainians have been no part of those particular discussions.
Have you had any sense of readout from the Russians, Tom?
Certainly the Russians have been pretty vocal sort of throughout in the run-up to the meeting and some in Moscow during it as well. They are very much framing this as the restoration of relations with Washington. And remember how significant that is, because it has been 3 years since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Vladimir Putin, 3 years of economic sanctions, the attempt by the West, led by Washington, to try to target Russia's economy to deter Vladimir Putin from continuing and intensifying the war. And the Americans are really quite openly now stating that their end game is to try and undo all that. So that, for the Russians, is a big win, I think, already. And certainly that's what they're putting a lot of emphasis on.
Tom, you mentioned that, you know, this process has now been set up as far as the Americans are concerned. There has been a sense from President Trump that, look, we want to get it done as quickly as possible. I was struck by Marco Rubio saying this is the first step of what is going to be a long and difficult journey. What sense do you have of just how much of a sort of galloping hurry the Americans are in?
Well, President Trump campaigned on this, and it was a core like proposal of his foreign policy to the American electorate to end it quickly. I mean, he said to start with he'd do it in a day, even before he was elected. Now, clearly that hasn't happened. But you do get the sense, I mean, Marco Rubio, I think, is one of the interesting things about this administration is we're starting to hear often some discrepancy in the way things are being described. And yes, I think Marco Rubio becomes a bit of a sort of anchor to this process, whereas the White House clearly wants it done as quickly as possible. But they are certainly looking beyond an end of war settlement and talking in terms of, you know, economic opportunities between the US and Russia. Now, that's something that you would only get after a sustainable peace has been achieved. But we don't know anything about the terms of getting to that point first. The other point is about being in a hurry in a negotiation might lose you some leverage. And we know that Mr. Trump was elected on that very promise that he would get this done quickly.
Tom Bateman, our State Department correspondent, speaking to me from Riyadh, from where that meeting has taken place between the Russians and the Americans. Professor Angela Stent is a former US intelligence official dealing with Moscow. She's now director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University in Washington. Owen Matthews is Russia editor for The Spectator magazine in the UK. He's also an author of Overreach, the Inside Story of Putin's War Against Ukraine. Welcome to you both. Angela, we've heard sort of positive noises from both the Americans and the Russians. Are you clearer as to what the contours of this negotiation might be?
So, I mean, what the Russians wanted from this was the restoration of economic and political relations with the U.S., the legitimization of Putin again, who'd been shunned by the West since the war began. And I think from the Trump administration's point of view, they also want to restore relations with Russia. They talk about investment opportunities. I think that's actually overblown if you think about the history of U.S.-Russian economic relations, but we can put that aside. I think the Russian delegation that was there was certainly not empowered to discuss the end of the Ukraine war. Putin's not interested in ending the war. The Trump people are. So that's clearly going to be a sticking point going forward. But I think they do agree, you know, on the restoration of relations and, you know, getting rid of, and I'm looking at the communique here, the mutual irritants in the relationship.
Right. Owen, do you see it similarly? And do you agree with Angela in terms of this idea that Putin is not seriously interested in peace?
Yes, Professor Stent's absolutely right about that, that he doesn't need to make peace. I think you can make an argument there are various reasons why this war is costing him a lot of money, but there is no compellence strategy. And that's kind of the bottom line of all these talks going forward, is that actually Putin is going to have to agree to everything that is finally on the table. He can't actually realistically be forced. I mean, concerning the end of the war, I mean, I'm put in mind of something that Mikhailo Podolyak, who is one of Vladimir Zelensky's oldest advisors, said to me many years ago, shortly after the beginning of the war. He said, this war will be over as quickly as it began, and the Russians will pretend it never happened. And unfortunately, it looks rather like that's exactly what the Russians are trying to do. They're trying to pretend that Bucha never happened, that they're going to their main bottom line is to go back to business as usual, with the emphasis on the business.
And yet, Angela Stent, Marco Rubio did also say that everyone has to be happy out of these negotiations. He also said, of course, the Europeans need to take part in these discussions over Ukraine. I mean, he was at least sort of saying the words that this isn't just going to be a carve-up between the big powers.
Well, he was certainly saying that. And if you look at things that he said while he was a senator, he was very hawkish on Russia and supportive of Ukraine. I think you do have to ask yourself how much decision-making power he has. You can ask the same thing about Lavrov, too. And I think you have to understand that there will be a small circle of people around President Trump. And I think Mr. Witkoff, who was present at these talks, is one of those people. And they'll probably have a greater say in deciding what happens, frankly, than the State Department will. So I think that really is going to come down to a question of who wields the most power there.
And Owen, do you think, I mean, obviously, we're getting beyond ourselves, but if there were some sort of deal that could be hatched, I mean, which may maybe, in, you know, freezes this conflict rather than there being a what we could call a peace deal. How much do you think America and Russia, you know, can agree the terms of how any ceasefire is policed?
Well, I think it's been devastatingly obvious for some time, the basic parameters of how this war will end. It will end with de facto, but not de jure, partition of Ukraine along a line of control. We don't know where that's going to be, ultimately, when the deal is, when the ceasefire comes. And security guarantees for Ukraine short of NATO membership. And we don't know exactly what the security guarantees are going to be. But that's the shape of it. It's pretty clear. I think the idea of peacekeeping forces, it was actually one of the very few specific things that Lavrov said in his remarks specifically about Ukraine. He didn't really address the precise outline of the deal. But one of the things that he said very clearly is having NATO peacekeepers on the ground was, quote, completely unacceptable.
Mm, and he also, I think, had to say that, you know, it shouldn't be a false flag operation. It shouldn't be an EU operation. Indeed, any NATO troops would be unacceptable as far as he's concerned. I mean, Angela, do you think that there is perhaps a bigger picture here, that the US is, in a sense, you know, trying to prise Russia away a little bit from the ambit of China, that yes, Ukraine, you know, may be downplayed here, but that maybe President Trump and his team are seeing a bigger geopolitical picture?
Well, they certainly are, and they've actually been, some of them have been explicit about it, that they see this. They seem to believe that if they negotiate with Putin and give him most of what he wants, which it looks as if they will now, that that will somehow induce him to rethink the relationship with China. That's really not going to happen. I mean, what Putin wants, of course, is recognition as a great power, but there are very few incentives for Russia to pry itself away from China, because that relationship has really intensified since the war began. So I think, but I do think that's part of their agenda. And I think, again, they're going to be disappointed if they really believe. I mean, Putin and his officials are still saying that the main enemy is the United States. They haven't said it in the last month or so since President Trump was inaugurated. But, you know, a lot of the other commentators do. So to think that Russia is really going to rethink its relationship with China, I think, is an illusion.
Professor Angela Stent and Owen Matthews, thank you both very much for your time, and we'll be hearing from Ukraine from our international editor in just a couple of minutes here on NewsHour. Also coming up on the programme, we'll be hearing from Germany, where an ancient village, which was due for demolition because of its proximity to a huge open cast mine, has just been saved.
Obviously, this massive hole in the ground, that had to stop. It's a sin against the environment. But that wasn't how we thought back then. We thought we were moving out so that everybody could have electricity. So that was the sacrifice we thought we had to make.
The local authority has now bought the village back from the mining company. This has never happened in Germany before.
That report from Germany in about 25 minutes. Our main headline this hour, the US and Russia have agreed to press ahead with negotiations aimed at ending Russia's war against Ukraine after their first high-level meeting since the invasion 3 years ago. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. Back to our top story now, the face-to-face talks between the top Russian and US officials about ending the war in Ukraine. We tried to pick apart what the US and Russian bottom lines may be, but, and this is a question we're often asking at the moment, what about Ukraine's position on all this? Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, has headed to the northeast of the country, to Sumy, close to the Kursk region of Russia, currently part-occupied by Ukraine.
Come to a village outside Sumy, and in a small wooden house with a cat, we are just going into a place where they're fixing drones. And in the room there are a number of large Ukrainian soldiers. Hello, good morning.
Monday.
And drones. Never seen so many drones in my life. How many drones?
Can't tell you.
It's a military secret, but I can tell you there are shelves and shelves and shelves of drones. Small ones.
They're really deadly, I'll tell you that. Even the small ones can carry like around 1 kilogram of munitions, with the bigger ones that you can see over there can carry like 3 kilos.
The diplomatic eruption in relations between the United States, Ukraine, and the rest of Europe that's been happening in the last few days hasn't reached this place. I can't say exactly where we are. We've agreed not to give it away, but suffice to say we're close to the Russian border. And the soldiers here are getting on with what they've been doing now for 3 years, which is trying to win the war against the Russians.
One of the soldiers preparing the drones for action was Andrew. They asked us to use only their first names for security reasons. Andrew was a drone pilot until the Russians discovered his position. He survived the attack, but one of his legs was amputated.
When you hear Zelensky saying, "I will not accept any deal that doesn't include Ukrainians being part of the negotiation," would you agree with that?
I didn't really have much time to think about it. It's like a 24/7 job, and you know, we are more. It's more important for us, like what's happening right now on the front line, to, you know, support our boys that are over there, the infantry.
We drove back towards Sumy through the snow and bitter cold. Ukrainians used to grumble about the way that Joe Biden, when he was president, always needed a lot of persuasion to increase the firepower he was prepared to offer them. But they always knew that he was on their side. Donald Trump is a different matter. They're still reeling at the speed with which he brought President Putin back from international isolation.
We've come to a big housing development in the east of Sumy, where a couple of weeks ago there was a big attack by it's one of the Shahed drones they deduced from the wreckage, and 11 people were killed here. It's an 8 or 10 story block. There's a massive hole right in the middle of it, spanning, well, 3 stories. You can see the insides of the apartment. The guts have been ripped out of the place. The whole building's now been evacuated because it's dangerous. So, look, I've come here to try and talk to some of the people around here about whether they think Putin and Trump can do a deal, and frankly, they're sceptical. I'm just going to talk to Boris. He was a colonel in the Soviet Army for 30 years. His son and his grandson are fighting in the Ukrainian Army at the moment.
We need to think about peace, but we shouldn't surrender. I don't see any point. We will resist until we have enough strength. Europe seems like they are ready to help us. There is actually a hope that Europe will support us.
Yulia, a woman in her early 30s, was out walking her Jack Russell. Like Boris, she does not trust President Putin.
Yes, it's possible, but they need to stop bombing us first. There can only be peace when they stop doing that. It needs to come from their side, because they started this horror.
Towards the end of the day and right through the evening, long trails of tracer from thudding Ukrainian anti-aircraft batteries arced lazily into the sky. Sumy is close to the border, is often attacked, and the flight paths of Russian drones heading deeper into Ukraine cross the night sky.
And that was our international editor Jeremy Bone reporting from Ukraine. If I were to ask you what's the most accessible and democratic of art forms, what would you say? Well, the answer, according to our next guest, is poetry, which is why he says it's absolutely right, indeed you could argue overdue, that there be a national poetry centre for the United Kingdom, for the country of Shakespeare and Keats, not to mention current stars like Raymond Antrobus and Lem Sisse. But a poetry centre to do what exactly? Simon Armitage is the UK's poet laureate and the man behind the project, which has just got state funding today. What's his case for it being the most accessible and democratic of art forms?
If you're feeling upset about something or want to express yourself, it's quite complicated and expensive to stage an opera or throw a pot. But you do have access to poetry because, for most people, language is a free gift. It's something that they've learned before they even know it. And if you have that and something to write with and on, you're away.
And, of course, these days there are more and more opportunities for us to share that, for example, through social media. In what way do you then think that a national poetry centre, how can that be a sort of crucible for poetry?
One of the things that's happened over the last few years is that we've become more and more isolated and solipsistic. And there's an invitation in a centre like this to gather. For younger generations, it's absolutely imperative that we invest in places where people can communicate face to face and, you know, learn how to disagree and be accepting of each other's opinions.
Why Leeds?
This is my part of the world. I'm a professor of poetry at Leeds University. And there's been a great appetite and energy for this idea shown from Leeds right from the beginning. There's also something of a drive in Leeds towards making it a city of language and literacy. Beyond that, it's roughly in the middle of the country. It's very well connected. We've already got a huge number of national institutions in our capital. But I think of late there's been a sort of philosophical move towards decentralisation, which reflects really what's happened in poetry as well. And I think it's just more reflective of a plurality within the art form.
And celebrating that plurality and celebrating the colours of the national language, is there going to be space for languages? Because obviously Britain has a multiplicity.
Yeah, exactly. And the area of Leeds that we're talking about is typically diverse. So, yes, when we talk about Britain and we talk about languages, we're talking about that great richness, which poetry has really benefited from in our country and which a lot of particularly younger people are finding a means of expression to talk about their own lives and what the world means to them through their own language. There's no better way, really, of being in touch with your identity than through your grammar and through your syntax. At some level, I can see that a national poetry centre might seem to some people an esoteric idea, but really what we're doing here is we're trying to encourage people to have a better relationship with language and to play with language, because in doing that, you get closer to yourself and you get closer to understanding the world.
The UK Poet Laureate Simon Armitage on the new National Poetry Centre, which has just been announced for the United Kingdom. This is NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Clinics in Nigeria are among those facing uncertainty following President Trump's freeze on US aid spending. Among those who could be affected are millions living with HIV and AIDS, many in sub-Saharan Africa. Our West Africa correspondent Nkechi Ogbonna has this report from Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos.
It already seems to be affecting HIV-positive Nigerians like Anike, whose name we have changed because she fears the stigma of her condition. She is set to lose access to the drugs she takes daily.
I'm not feeling comfortably because I'm feeling as if I'm dying already. I worry about it too because ARV drug is for life.
The mother of five has been living with HIV for 19 years, kept alive, she says, by antiretroviral drugs, which prevent HIV developing into AIDS. But now, her drug supply has stopped, and she's worried.
I always fall sick. Rashes in my body, swelling every time, and tiredness. But when I started taking the medication, I feel all right. And nobody knows I am HIV positive or not.
Nigeria and other countries in sub-Saharan Africa have relied on a flow of drugs funded by PEPFAR. That's the US president's emergency program for AIDS relief. It spent more than $100 billion in 50 countries globally since it was founded in 2003. In Nigeria alone, America has spent almost $8 billion. For Anike and many others, that funding flow has stopped for now.
I must confess to you that there's a telephone line I have to switch it off because of the bombardment for requests for medication. I don't know where to go. I don't know how to respond to those requests for ARVs. I don't know. So that is number one. Number two, I am telling you, by the end of March, all the general hospitals, all the government hospitals, including private hospitals in Nigeria, should be ready for bombardment of sick people, bombardment of people who want treatment.
That's Rex Adjenifuja, director at Hope for HIV/AIDS International, a non-government organization and beneficiary of U.S. aid operations in Nigeria. He believes the $3 million the Nigeria government approved in the aftermath of U.S. aid for the immediate treatment of people living with HIV is insufficient.
That is peanuts. When you compare figures, you compare the data. ARV drug alone costs between 15,000 and 30,000. So you are giving me only 10% of that amount of ARV alone. What about other opportunistic infections?
It's in places like this, Africa's most populous country, where the impact of decisions taken in Washington are likely to be most sharply felt. The uncertainty and the fear caused by President Trump's new policies are real. Beneficiaries of U.S. aid like Anike have a message for him.
HIV drug is for life, life treatment. We can't do without taking it. It's only death that can separate us from taking ARV.
Anike, an HIV patient, ending that report from Nkechi Ogbonna in Lagos. You're with the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. It's a big day for a ceasefire in the Middle East, not Gaza this time, but Lebanon, because today, as stipulated by the deal which ended the conflict between Israel and the Hezbollah militia, Israel was due to withdraw completely from southern Lebanon. Lebanese officials have confirmed that Israeli troops have pulled out from villages in the region, but the IDF has said that it's retaining a presence on five key hilltop outposts inside Lebanon, just over Israel's northern border, a decision which the UN says should count as a violation of the agreement ending the war. Our correspondent Ugo Bashega joins us from southern Lebanon. Ugo, I guess probably the Israeli withdrawal has not been sort of within your eye line, but what sense have you got of people going back to places that hitherto they haven't been able to?
Yeah, so I am in Kifakila, which is a village right next to the Israeli border. And people are, as expected, returning with Hezbollah flags, with posters of the late leader Hassan Nasrallah. This is an area of Lebanon where Hezbollah still has a very significant, very strong presence and support. But it is a very somber mood here. You know, there are no revolutionary chants, no songs, no music being played, because the destruction here in this particular village is widespread. And I think this is the first opportunity that many people had to see the destruction by the war, to see what is left of their homes. And for many of these families, there's nothing really left here in this particular village. And
right.
This is obviously the situation in many other villages along the border.
And is there any evidence of there being, I mean, given just how weak the Lebanese government has been for so long, and obviously how poor it is as well in many ways, just of that reconstruction effort underway?
I think this is one of the key questions going forward, because we're talking about $10 billion at least to rebuild what's been destroyed in terms of economic damage as well. And nobody really knows who's going to pay for that, because the Lebanese authorities, the government, doesn't have the money. International partners are saying that they will only help the Lebanese authorities if they take action to curb Hezbollah's power, curb Hezbollah's influence in the country. And in these areas controlled by Hezbollah, essentially what people are saying is that, look, we're waiting for Hezbollah to help us in this process. But we know that Hezbollah is under pressure. Iran, which is Hezbollah's main supporter, doesn't really have the means, the ability to fund all this reconstruction. So obviously, you know, it's going to be a very long and difficult road ahead for the country.
Ugo, we'll have to leave it there because unfortunately the line was breaking up, but we got the sense of what you were saying as people do begin to return to, well, what's left of their homes in southern Lebanon after that war of last year. Sidon is the biggest city in the south of Lebanon. Abdulrahman Bisri represents Sidon in the Lebanese parliament. He's an independent MP, not affiliated with any of the major political factions. What does he make of today's developments?
First of all, this is a sovereign issue to Lebanon because the Israeli occupying forces have stayed in Lebanon and they did not commit themselves to complete withdrawal from the Lebanese territory. This is, means that the occupation of Lebanon or certain parts of Lebanon has continued despite international guarantees.
Well, just to be clear about that, the Israeli foreign minister has said we are temporarily remaining in these five strategic key high points for our security. So, he is making it clear that as far as he's concerned, it is temporary and it's just going to be until they get assurances, they say, that the Lebanese state has properly taken over security in the south of the country.
For our knowledge, the Lebanese army is really deployed in all areas that the Israeli army has left. So there is no reason why the Israelis should be worried. Our belief that although it is temporary, it is some sort of what you call reinforcing certain conditions on the Lebanese state.
You say that the Lebanese army has deployed throughout southern Lebanon, but I mean there's a difference between it deploying and the complete dismantling of Hezbollah infrastructure, both above ground and below ground. It's also different, clearly, from Hezbollah giving up its arms and its huge number of weapons, some of them pretty long-range weapons that it has. So, I just wonder whether you're perhaps overstating the threat that the Israelis are posing right now.
You see, what we know is that Lebanon now has entered a new era. We have a new president, we have a new prime minister, we have even a new cabinet, and they have even adopted what we call a new paradigm in defense, which states that we have a defensive army. So if the Israeli occupational forces remained occupying in Lebanon, then the argument for the government to re-establish itself politically and security-wise will be also challenged. We want to feel that there is a chapter which has been closed and we are opening a new chapter in Lebanon because this is the only way for the country to stabilize.
You talk about a fresh start with this government. You talk about the danger of being dragged back into the sort of the old lines of confrontation. I just wonder whether you, as an independent member of parliament, are also hoping that this could be a Lebanon where perhaps Hezbollah does not exert such influence on the country, because it has been enormously powerful inside Lebanon. Do you think that could be part of the news story?
Well, you see, in Lebanese politics has always been affected by what you call regional balance. You know now that the regional balance is have really tipped following the war in Gaza and the war in Lebanon. If you look even at the cabinet itself in Lebanon, you know that also the balance in the cabinet is different than the previous governments that controlled Lebanon over the past 20 years. You can see that there is now a new atmosphere in politics, that the country is really undergoing a significant political metamorphosis. So the only way to preserve this political metamorphosis in this delicate and very sensitive period is really to eliminate the Israeli influence. Because if the Israeli influence continues in Lebanon through occupation of certain areas, albeit 5 points, then there will always be a reason to worry about the potential eruption of hostilities.
Abdulrahman Bisri, an independent member of the Lebanese parliament, representing Sidon in the south of the country. On Sunday, almost 60 million German voters will elect a new federal parliament in snap elections after the collapse of the governing coalition of Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Social Democrats, along with the Greens and the Liberals, back in November last year. A likely change of government with the participation of the Conservatives and their lead candidate for Chancellor Friedrich Merz could change the approach to net zero, Germany's ambitious target of achieving climate neutrality within 20 years. That's being increasingly contested. Tim Mansell has this report from the village of Burgerwald.
About half an hour west of Cologne, there's a huge hole in the ground, man-made, several hundred metres deep. People drive for miles to come and have a look.
I'm a little bit speechless. I hadn't think that it's so big here. I had the map on Google Maps and I saw this big hole on the map and I say, hey, we have to go here, and it's incredible.
It's an open-cast coal mine in operation since the early 1980s. But they're going to stop mining here in 4 years' time.
And then we will try to install one of the biggest lakes in Germany here.
This is Boris Linden. He's the head of Neuland Hambach, a company whose job it is to come up with a plan to remake the whole of this area for the post-fossil fuel era. And where's the water coming from?
There needs to be built a pipeline from 45 kilometers from the River Rhine to this spot. This process will need about 40 years.
Over the last 40 years, this mine has swallowed everything in its path, including a number of ancient villages. That's not unusual in Germany, and most people accepted the deal on offer. The mining company would buy their house, and they'd build a new one in a new village. But after a series of government decisions, one village here is not, after all, going to be torn down.
Das war wie so ein Schlag ins Gesicht.
Inga Dormes says the news was like a punch in the face. She'd already moved out and built her new house. Now she discovered this hadn't been necessary. Inga represents the village. It's called Morschenich on the local authority.
Obviously, this massive hole in the ground, that had to stop. It's a sin against the environment. But that wasn't how we thought back then. We thought we were moving out so that everybody could have electricity. So that was the sacrifice we thought we had to make.
The local authority has now bought the village back from the mining company. This has never happened in Germany before.
The Kirche war noch intact.
Georg Gehlhausen led that process. He's the mayor of the local authority in nearby Merzenich. Why did he want to save the village from the bulldozers?
Weil wir halt zwar darin eine große und schwierige Aufgabe sehen.
Because while it's a large and difficult undertaking, we also see it as a huge opportunity. And at the end of the day, if we didn't buy it, then who would? In the worst case, you could see a foreign investor coming in and making money off it, so we said, no, this village belongs to this community.
A few minutes' drive from Morschenich is the village of Mannheim. Well, what used to be a village. There's not much left now. This is the fate that Morschenich has avoided.
It's so quiet. How does it feel, Boris, to be walking through this village?
The atmosphere is not very warm, to be honest.
It's quite eerie.
Yeah.
I'm with Boris Linden, the man who wants to fill the mine with water. There are still a few houses standing here, but soon they'll be gone too. Only the church will remain, because it's subject to a preservation order. Boris Linden has a plan for that.
So you can imagine classical concerts as well as DJ parties for the young generation.
DJ nights or classical concerts. How far will people have to travel to get here to come to events like that?
Well, there are 160,000 people living in this area. And we are surrounded by even bigger cities like Cologne, 1 million inhabitants. Düsseldorf, 800,000 inhabitants.
So this sad, abandoned church in this sad, abandoned village could become an entertainment destination.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Boris Linden, sharing his vision with Tim Mansell. You can hear more on this story on this week's assignment here on the BBC World Service. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Tim Franks. A British couple who were arrested in Iran last month during a round-the-world motorcycle trip have been charged with spying offences. Craig and Lindsay Foreman, who were both 52, are accused of collecting information in different locations across Iran. The pair are being held in the southern city of Kerman. The BBC's Azadeh Mashiri joins us live from Islamabad. Azadeh, what else are the Iranians saying?
Well, a lot of the information that we've been getting has been coming from Iranian state media. This latest information is from a judiciary-run news agency, and it even quoted a judiciary spokesman, Asghar Jahangir, saying the couple had been under surveillance by intelligence agencies in the province and were, in their words, arrested as part of a coordinated intelligence operation. They're arguing that the couple came under the guise, the pretense of a tourist trip, but actually were collecting information for Western intelligence officials. Now, this is completely different to what we've heard from Lindsay and Craig Foreman's family and also from Lindsay Foreman's own social media accounts, because what's really notable about this case is that since they were embarking on this trip across the world on their motorbikes, they'd already posted so many videos and pictures of their time in various countries, including Armenia, the country they were in before they got into Iran. And throughout, you see a very positive outlook, especially in Iran. Lindsay Foreman talks about how she's there having an amazing time, enjoying the food, talking about shared humanity. And a lot of this is because she's a life coach. She has a doctorate in psychology. And the purpose of this trip was to end up in Australia as their final stop, where Lindsay would present her research on what it means to live a good life. And in fact, they'd only planned on staying in Iran for 5 days and instead have been detained since early January.
And just to be clear, I mean, although you said it was a brief visit and all the PR around this was, look, we're showing the benefits of a shared humanity. I mean, there is a pretty clear British government travel advisory about Iran, isn't there?
There is. The Foreign Office currently advises British nationals to avoid all travel to Iran. It adds that, you know, British and British-Iranian dual nationals are at significant risk of arrest, questioning or detention. It even says that having a British passport or connections to the UK can be reason enough for the Iranian authorities to detain you. But they actually knew about these risks. It's very clear because Lindsay Foreman posted about it on social media prior to making the trip. They said they're facing their fears and defying recommendations from friends, family and the FCDO travel advice. She acknowledged that traveling to Iran and to Pakistan, which was her next stop, was risky and, in her words, slightly scary, but that they hoped the reward would be worth it and that they'd hired a tour guide and were taking every precaution. They said that they believed they'd be able to really show that the world had some form of shared humanity and that they were doing this with the best of intentions.
Azadeh Mashiri in Islamabad. Thank you very much. Donald Trump has returned to power with a particularly muscular and energetic display of executive power from behind his oak desk in the Oval Office. One big question is whether he's had the right to exert such power. And the question is due to have its first big test in the Supreme Court today as the White House appeals to the justices to allow the president to fire a government lawyer who leads or led an agency which deals with ethics and whistleblowers. That agency head, he's called Hampton Dellinger, has said that his sacking in a brief email was not properly justified. Amy Howe is the co-founder and writer for SCOTUS blog. It's a news website all about the Supreme Court, and I'm delighted to say that Amy's in the NewsHour studio. Why does this case matter, Amy?
It matters because, as you said, this is the first time that the Trump administration has come to the Supreme Court. There are literally dozens of lawsuits in the federal courts in the United States challenging all of these various actions that the president has taken since his inauguration on January 20th. And this is the first time that the Trump administration has come to the Supreme Court and asked the justices to step in. And so the question, you know, A, this is just in and of itself a particularly important test of his ability to fire this particular official. But also, you know, I think we're all watching to what extent will this serve as a bellwether for how the Supreme Court might deal with other cases involving the president's actions when they come to the Supreme Court.
Right. And if we've got time, we'll come on to that. But just in terms of this particular case, I mean, presumably the administration will argue that, you know, the head of the executive has a right to fire the head of an agency that he controls.
That's exactly their argument. They say that the president should have the power and has the power to remove senior officials whenever he wants to. And they point to a couple of recent Supreme Court cases in which the Supreme Court has held that restrictions on the president's ability to remove heads of agencies are unconstitutional. Now, Hampton Dellinger, the head of this Office of Special Counsel, says, you know, not so fast, because the statute that created the Office of Special Counsel says that normally a president can remove a senior official whenever he wants. But in this case, the president can only remove the head of the Office of Special Counsel for a good cause, for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. And the president didn't mention any of those in the email when he fired me.
As you mentioned, I mean, the Supreme Court, lots and lots of people are saying it could find itself in pretty short order in the center of an almighty constitutional tussle over just how much power the White House and President Trump has. What's your view on sort of how it will see that and how it will try and navigate that?
You know, I'm not sure that this case is actually a bellwether. There are, you know, many different cases involving a bunch of different issues that could bubble up to the Supreme Court. You know, we're also looking at the question of birthright citizenship. You know, when you're talking about this case in particular, you know, there's a law professor named Stephen Vladeck at Georgetown University Law Center, who's one of the sharpest commentators on the court. And he says, you know, on the one hand, that the government does have a very strong argument that the president can likely remove the head of the Office of Special Counsel. On the other hand, in this particular case, at this particular time, it's a really unusual procedural posture, so to speak, that you can't necessarily learn a lot of lessons from what the court does with this case right now.
With this case right now, but do you imagine that pretty soon, you know, the Constitution is going to be stress tested in the Supreme Court?
There are lots of cases, you know, bubbling up in the birthright citizenship case, you know, cases involving care for transgender young people, cases involving immigration. And really the question is which one of these cases are going to come to the Supreme Court and when. The Supreme Court, for the most part, has filled its docket for the year. They normally hear cases through the end of April. But as we saw with the law that purported to ban TikTok, the Supreme Court can act very quickly when it wants to.
Amy Howe, it's been great to have you here on NewsHour. Thank you very much. And that's it from this edition of the program. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.